Okay. Does anybody remember what we're covering today? Yeah, no. No Bloody Marys today. We're on the Scots. We're going to start our little survey of Scottish church history from the Reformation forward today. So here we go. I'll see how far we can get. We're already 11:20, so I probably won't get through everything, which means I won't get to the early days of John Knox, most likely, but we'll see what I can do. Williston Walker says that at the dawn of the 16th century, Scotland was a poor and backward country. Its social conditions were feudal. The power of its kings was small. Its nobles were turbulent. Its church was relatively rich in land, owning about one half of the country. But ecclesiastical positions were largely based as a supply for young sons of nobles and clerical property. As a result, many were angry in Scotland with the Catholic Church because it owned half of the country and had an income that was nearly 18 times that of the King of Scotland, who wasn't necessarily all that strong, though, either. The Scottish churches basically were filled with bishops who were political appointments, who pursued a lot of greed and worldliness, and who were not afraid to not hide their immoral lives, such as Cardinal Beaton, who was the Archbishop of St. Andrews, who consorted with many concubines and sired 10 children out of wedlock. Parish churches were often subject to neglect, staffed by ill-educated and poorly trained and often illiterate priests. So you have conditions in Scotland at the time of the Reformation, which I don't know that they're all that different than some places in Europe. There's social unrest, but it's not as big as we might want to make it out to sound. Clearly, there is a restlessness, but I wouldn't say it's similar to a fire with just low embering coals that with some work will get going. It's a lot more complicated than that. We underappreciate how much church dominated everything. And to change that would be an enormous task. But one way it did start was through traders, Scottish traders, not traitors, but traders, tradesmen, merchants, who would go back and forth between Scotland and the continent and bring merchandise back, and along with it they would bring back theological works of Martin Luther, and later on they would start bringing Bibles. You have to remember that there was no Bible in English. These people didn't read the Bible. You think that they were sitting around having their family devotions every day? You're wrong. They couldn't even read, but if they could read, there wouldn't be a Bible. So the first thing that they got their hands on that would have been in their own language was some of Luther's early tracts. They start to circulate, which is an interesting idea, that the most Presbyterian of all of the nations that emerged from the Reformation starts out Lutheran. But over time, this scruffy group of individuals began to experience a work of reformation. John Knox says it happened as God gave his spirit to simple men. I think it's an interesting assessment. There's no delusions of grandeur. He says he gave his spirit to simple men. I think that's a good way to describe the Scottish people prior to the Reformation. Culturally, Scotland was not a rich nation. It was not rich in culture. It was just, they were sheep herders, basically. There's nothing wrong with being a sheep herder. It just was not a prominent nation, as you think of wealth and so forth, and military might and culture and learning and so forth. So I want to start my exposition of Scottish history by looking to the martyrs, the Scottish martyrs. I'm going to begin with Patrick Hamilton. Patrick Hamilton was born in 1504. He's a little bit different in the fact that he was an aristocrat. He was the son of an aristocrat. His father was a nobleman. His uncle was a sheriff, which was pretty big business in those days. And his bloodlines were tied to King James V of Scotland. So he does have somewhat of a pedigree that's going to contrast to Knox. Patrick was well-educated, at least according to the standards of Scotland in that day. And when he was 14 years old, he was engrafted into the church orders. So he was able to gain a monetary stipend to go study abroad when he was 14. So he went to Paris, and he interacted with the elite scholars of the Sorbonne. By 1520, he took his degree at the University of Paris, and then he went to Louvain, which is in Belgium, to study under Erasmus, because he was interested in the new learning and linguistics and languages. While he was there, he seemed to pick up a healthy dose of Platonic philosophy, which couldn't necessarily be bad in some ways, and he developed his skill in philosophy. So he was a theologian, a philosopher, and a linguist. Then he went on to Marburg, after that to Wittenberg, where he studied a little bit with Luther and Melanchthon. And here is where he begins to pick up a very solid understanding of the doctrine of justification by faith alone. Now again, remember I said that the tracts that are coming into Scotland are Lutheran. Here is Patrick Hambleton, you would say the very first reformer of Scotland. He sat at the feet of Luther in Wittenberg, and when he comes back to Scotland, guess what he's preaching? Lutheranism, essentially. He also published a work that put him on the radar screen of the ecclesiastical rulers in Scotland. It's called Patrick's Places, where he took a lot of shots at what he considered to be difficulties, doctrinal difficulties in Romish theology. By 1522 and on to early 1523, he comes back to Scotland to visit his family, and he is enrolled in holy orders. But since he's not 25, which is the law, he can't officially preach. So there's some question as to whether he was fully ordained or not, but it seems as if he had done something and had some formal relationship with the church there. And he goes about preaching. Now bear in mind that right about this time, there is a movement within the Scottish Parliament to ban this so-called reformish preaching and literature. 17 July of 1525, the Parliament passed an act against the literature, and I'm going to try to read it, but it's not in English, at least not that we use. It says, "Of all such filth and vice, that nay manner of person stranger that happens to arrive with their opinions within part of this realm," and I'm translating the best I can, "bring with them any bookis or verkis of said Lutherus and his disciples," goes on to say, they're in trouble, basically. I should email out this Scottish, old Scottish brogue, because it's quite interesting to read. But they call them these disciples of Lutherus. At any rate, the act was extended in 1527, and the Catholic authorities had the right to arrest people who were preaching this. This new false doctrine of Lutheranism in the country. Also, it is extended to the Tyndale translation of the New Testament. Those were forbidden at this time as well. And so he goes around preaching in the country. And the more he preached, the more people listened to Patrick. I suppose he was a young, fiery preacher, well-studied, articulate, trained. And so as the word about his preaching grows, he is invited by the Archbishop of St. Andrews to come and debate with the Roman theologians at the university. And so he did. As a young kid, he got suckered into the trap, and he argued with the Roman theologians until they could get just enough evidence on him to fry him. What they did is they recorded his debates, and they found plenty of heretical doctrine being taught. And so he is now arraigned. Let me list to you the charges that were made against Hambleton. The man has no free will. There is no purgatory. The holy patriarchs were in heaven before Christ's passion. The Pope hath no power to loose and bind. The Pope is the Antichrist. Master Patrick Hambleton was a bishop. It was not necessary to obtain any bulls from the bishop. The vow of the Pope's religion was a vow of wickedness. And the list goes on and on of the sins that the charges against Patrick. He's saying he's denying many of these things, of course. The last one on his charges is that he denies auricular confession was necessary to salvation, but being a good Lutheran, he wouldn't have denied confession. But, you know, these are the charges that came up. These are the things that he was debating. And so he was sentenced to death. No sooner were the charges against him settled that Hamilton was rushed to the stake. It was after dinner on 28 February 1527 that they stoked a fire out in front of the old college. As he was brought out to the stake, he took off his outer clothing and he gave it to the servant who was there assisting in the execution. Hamilton is recorded as saying, "The stuff will not help me in the fire, yet will do you some good. I have no more to leave you but the example of my death, which I pray you would keep in mind. For albeit the same be bitter and painful in man's judgment, yet is the entrance into eternal life, which none can inherit who deny Christ before this wicked generation." So he was tied to a stake, and some black powder was put around his neck. I'll give you that in a moment. The problem was, as they lit the fire, it didn't kindle well. They had been in such a rush to execute him and to burn him that they had not gathered sufficient amounts of dry wood. And so they tried to light this wet wood, and a fierce wind blew up. And it blew the fire out repeatedly, and the gunpowder somehow got wet. It had been tied around his neck, and it barely was the equivalent of a firecracker. Enough to insult him, but not to hurt him. So it scorched his face and a little bit of his hands. And so he sat there while they continued to bring out wood and try to some way ignite this fire. Hamilton's last words were, as he was standing in the blazes, were, "How long, O Lord, shall darkness oppress this realm? How long will you suffer this tyranny? Lord Jesus, receive my spirit." So Hamilton died on 28 February 1528, after quite some time standing in the hot coals and charcoals until it sufficiently consumed him. I want to take just a moment to tell you a little bit about burning at the stake. I read quite a bit about it during the reign of Mary, but it's rooted in an English act of Parliament. It was signed into law by the king. It's called the Orthodoxy of the Faith. It was used to kill heretics and witches. It would be fair to say that far more witches were burned at the stake than anybody else. Far more. And I was just talking with Zach about this because he's having to read this book at school about the terrible New England Puritans who were constantly burning witches at the stake. I just wanted to point out to him that this was common. It wasn't just Puritans. Everybody burned witches at the stake for hundreds of years in Western Europe. So just think it's worth throwing out there at least. And by this act, bishops were given authority to arrest and to fine all heretics and to burn their books. Scotland had a unique provision, however, which is that they were to tie gunpowder around their victims and a cord around their neck. There's division about why the cord was tied around the neck. Some are of the opinion that the cord was there to hold the person in place while they were burning so they wouldn't flail about in the fire. They would burn more easily. Others are of the opinion that the rope was tied around the neck so that people couldn't make famous last statements, which some of these guys, very interestingly, were willing to make, to make sure that their last words were recorded for posterity, and usually it was a rant about the government or something like that. So it's interesting to think about the process. They would have been tied to the stake, then tied about the neck, and then held in place while they burned. That's the first martyr, Patrick Hamilton. There were many others in between, but George Wishart's the one that I want to deal with because he's really the transitional figure who in many ways lays a foundation for the work of Knox. George Wishart was born about 1513. He was educated in Scotland during his early years. And in 1538, he was schooled at a place called Montrose, where he studied Greek. And it's interesting that while he was studying Greek at this particular school, he was charged of heresy, because it was considered to be heresy to learn Greek. that makes our head spin a little bit, but it was. You were not to read anything but the scriptures in Latin. So basically he's kicked out of town. He flees to England, where he gets himself into more trouble. By 1540, he has to leave England because he is charged with teaching heresy by Archbishop Cranmer. So he goes to the continent, and he ends up in Switzerland, where he interacts with the theologians of Zurich and so forth. And he comes back carrying with him the Swiss Confession of Faith, which he interprets into English. And so now you have Latin, and here you have rather Lutheranism, and here you have your first influence of what we'd call the Reformed side of the Reformation, and that is the Swiss Confession, which of course was penned by Heinrich Bullinger. We've looked at it extensively, at least the second Helvetic Confession. The first one is not as extensive, but it certainly would include some foundational Reformed doctrines. So now you have two influences. You have the influence of Wittenberg, and you have the influence of Zurich now circulating within Scotland. So he comes back, and what does he do? But he begins to preach. And while he preaches, he goes to a city named Dundee, and he preaches there, gains a fair reputation for being a preacher and so forth. And he leaves town, and 4 days after he leaves town, the plague comes to that town. And so what does he do? Well, he goes back. He goes back to Dundee, and he preaches. And his first sermon back was on Psalm 107, verse 20, where it says, "He sent his word and he healed them and he delivered them for their destructions." And one account is that he so comforted the people that they thought themselves happy in having such a preacher. And so they invited him to preach and to stay. And that he did. In fact, he became so involved in the help of the city of Dundee that he himself exposed himself to infection from the plague and got a little bit sick while he was there. There's also an interesting incident that happens while he was there. Cardinal Beaton hired a priest to assassinate Wishart. So one day after Wishart was done preaching, he came down from this makeshift sort of podium or platform he had been preaching on, and he noticed that there was a priest at the bottom of the podium who had been positioned there, and his hand was under his cloak. And as Wishart walked down, the priest pulled a knife out of from underneath his gown and attempted to stab Wishart, at which time Wishart slapped his hand and took the dagger away. So he must have known a little collie. He takes the dagger out of his hand and throws it to the ground. And so the people there, of course, this man had endeared himself to the populace of Dundee at this point because of his preaching and his pastoral care and even being willing to expose himself to the plague. The people got mad and wanted to lynch the priest. And yet Wishart grabbed the man and hugged him and says, "You'll do it only over my life." So the man went free, and that was the end of that story. But at least it's interesting, gives you some insight into the character of Wishart. While he's there, he's given a letter from a friend who asks him to come over to his house, which is in the place called Montrose. And about halfway there, we're told that Wishart stopped in his tracks. And he said, "I'm forbidden by God to go on this journey." He turned around and he went back to Edinburgh. Unbeknownst to him, that not far away from where he turned around, there were 60 horsemen in wait to arrest him and to kill him. Part of this strain that runs throughout Scottish lore, at least, you could say it's more than this if you like, is there's a strain of sort of prophesying, if you will, of future events. You'll notice that Hamilton does that a little bit in his parting words. You're definitely going to notice that Wishart does this. There are quotes from Knox and many others of these quotes about what they say is going to happen in the future, and they have an eerie way of coming to pass, at least in some ways. I'm just giving you one incident here from the life of Wishart where this, where he turns around in the middle of the journey sensing something is wrong. It turns out the letter was a forgery, and he would have been arrested and no doubt killed. So he goes back to Edinburgh, and he stays the night there with a friend next to Edinburgh. And in the middle of the night, he feels this horrible impulse come over him. So it was observed by people who were staying there with him that he went outside and he prostrated himself on the ground and began to roll around and pray in great intensity. And after a period of about an hour of groaning and weeping and making noise and so forth, he came back inside the house. And the people who had followed him and saw him do that, when he woke up in the next morning, asked him what he was doing that night. And Wishart replied by saying, "I wish you had been in your beds, which had been more for your ease, for I was scarcely occupied." But they pressed him further, and they asked him what he was doing. And he told them, "I will tell you assuredly, no, my travail is near at an end. Therefore, pray to God for me that I may not shrink back from the battle when it waxes most hot." So he has some sort of a sense that impending doom is on the horizon. And so Wishart asked that they would pray that God would comfort him and that he would be illuminated to continue to preach the gospel, which he did. So he preached there where he was at until January. And he moved on to a place called Ormiston. But before he left for Ormiston, he had a conversation with this man named Knox, who was his bodyguard. He used to carry around a claymore sword to defend him in case somebody tried to injure him while he was preaching. Of course, that was John Knox. And he told him that Knox should depart from him because he said one sacrifice is enough for Christ at this time. And of course, that was a timely conversation because 5 hours later he was arrested. He went to Ormiston where he intended to go. We're told that the host family received him for dinner. They had a vigorous conversation. They concluded it with the singing of Psalm 51, and they went to bed. At midnight, they heard a knocking on the door. It was the Earl of Bothwell, who demanded that they release unto him George Wishart. After lengthy conversation and negotiation, Bothwell promised the safety of Wishart's person, and so the head of the house released Wishart, and they sent him off. Of course, Bothwell gave him over then to the cardinal's deputies, and they took him to St. Andrew's, where he was arraigned on charges of heresy. He was taken before the local magistrate as well, and we're told that one of his accusers read off a list of charges and condemned him. Charges were frivolous, many of them, but some of them were theological in nature. And so they asked Knox, or rather Wishart, what his response was to all the charges, and he said, "Let God be the judge." And he left it at that. He didn't even try to defend himself. So the next day, he was hurried out to the stake. We're told that two executioners came to him. They covered him in black linen. They fastened to him a bag of gunpowder, and they put a rope about his neck. Now, I told you about this rope. It was there either to hold them still so they could burn quicker, not flail around, or to keep their mouth shut. So they bound him and they took him to the stake. And while he was there, one of the executioners turned to him after he had done offering his sermon. He had a chance to offer some sort of a short sermon where he admonished the people to lay hold of Christ and the salvation and exalt the word of God. And one of his executioners asked for his forgiveness, at which time we're told that Wishart embraced him and then commanded him to fulfill his office as executioner. And so they kindled the fire and they lit the black powder, and he blew up and he perished in the flames on the 1st of March of 1546. Now, this is an interesting occasion for a lot of reasons, because of the influence of Wishart's preaching. I wouldn't say that Wishart was as full-blown Presbyterian as John Knox was, but he was certainly far along the path. And that preaching, along with the tracts, the disbursement of the Bibles and so forth, led to what I would call a miniature lay revolution. And I mean miniature. It wasn't large, but it was growing. And it was growing to the point that after his execution, 3 months later, a group of, well, you could say they were thugs, or you could say they were Protestant heroes. You'd be the judge. I would say they're probably more thugs, though. Just bear that in mind. They stormed the castle of St. Andrews. They executed vengeance upon Cardinal Beaton himself, the one who was responsible for Knox's, or rather for Wishart's execution. And they stormed the castle and they held it for quite some time until the summer of the next year, until 1547. They took refuge in there. And it became known as a hideout for hooligans, thugs, and Protestants. John Knox ended up there. He was tired of being on the run. You'll remember that he had been released from the service of Wishart just hours before his arrest. But he had been hiding all over in Scotland and couldn't find any refuge. So he finally ended up at St. Andrews. And this is where we pick up the story of Knox. And we have a chance just to get into it a little bit. That's just enough to whet your appetite for next time. You have to remember, as I said, some of the people that were in the castle were thugs, and some wanted to be more Protestant. So he goes there, and he begins to teach. He's not a preacher yet. But before I get into telling you about what he does there at the castle, I should at least say this. It would be an understatement to say that not everybody likes John Knox. And when I say that not everybody likes John Knox, I don't mean just people who aren't Reformed or Protestant. John Knox has a bad reputation for being stubborn and inflexible and not a good team player. And I got that from my own church history professor at Westminster. So that gives you an insight into how even Reformed people think of John Knox. This quote from an article in Christianity Today, author Anonymous, gives you an insight into how more broadly evangelicalism might view John Knox. The statement says he was a minister of the Christian gospel who advocated violent revolution. John Knox was a man of many paradoxes. A Hebrew Jeremiah set down on Scottish soil. In a relentless campaign of fiery oratory, he sought to destroy what he felt was idolatry and to purify Scottish religion. I'll let you be the judge of who Knox is. I'm going to try to give you some insight into who he was. We certainly shouldn't engage in worship of the Reformers. They were sinful men who put their boots on just like we do. And so we have to realize that there are certain problems with people. But I would say that one reason why Knox attracts such bad press is, I'll give you two reasons. One, everybody hates him for his first blast of the regiment against, his first blast of the trumpet against the monstrous regiment of women rulers. Everybody hates him for that. Where he denounces Mary for being queen of Scotland, okay? So you have to understand that. Even Calvin wrapped his knuckles for that. I'd say another reason why people don't like Knox is because he tried to be, I think, most consistent in his application of reform principles across the board, to church government, to worship, to church life, to national life, in a way that no one else did, nor could even try. In their peculiar situations as they were, as the Reformation emerged in various cities in Europe. He did it in Scotland. What he accomplished was monumental, really. And but it didn't come without a lot of strife and a lot of change. I'm going to give you a little bit about his early life, and I'll have to stop because there's just not enough time. That's just a little bit of taste of maybe how people look at Knox. He was born in about 1513 to 1515, we're not exactly sure. There is debate about his actual date of birth. One unsubstantiated view that has been fairly popular is he's born in 1505. One substantiated view is from his friend Peter Young, who knew him his whole life, said that Knox died in his 59th year. He died in 1572, so you do the math. 1505 won't work. But he was born to people of relatively humble means. His father, William, had been a soldier, and his mother was one of those rare women in Scotland who'd actually been educated. Lang says Knox was not a man of pedigree. His ancestors were peasant farmers, and in that sense, he was more like what each Scot styled himself, quote, the king's poor cousin. So he would be kind of in a low state. Knox himself said, I'm a man of base estate and condition. Later on, when he became prominent within the affairs of the church and even politics in Scotland, in the 1560s, he said to the Earl of Bothwell, who was a muckety-muck, to say the least, My grandfather and my maternal grandfather and my father have all served under your lordship's predecessors, and some of them have died under their standards. And this, he said, is part of our obligation of Scottish kindness. So he views himself as one of the people, let's put it that way, to say the least. He does not consider himself to have been a part of the establishment in terms of the wealthy or the elite in any way. As a youngster, he grew up learning Latin in the Latin schools, and most likely he went to St. Andrews, although there's a name in the register of University of Glasgow of John Knox, but almost no one believes that was him. There's no record of him, official record of him being at St. Andrews, but he does seem to be familiar with one of the works of the professor, a man named Mayor, who went later on to Paris, who Calvin and Beza, many of the continental reformers, had also had interaction with. So there's probably good evidence that he had been to St. Andrews while Mayor was there. And he studied there. In some ways, you could say that St. Andrews, while he was there, was a hotbed of political activity as well as religious concern. So it could be that while he was there, some of his, he starts at least gaining an open ear to, at least sympathetic ear, should we say, to not revolt or revolution, but that something needs to change. He talks about some of the sermons that were preached by the Dominicans and the Franciscans, which in some ways ripped on the bishops. So you have to understand that even within the Roman Catholic Church at the time in Scotland, there were critics, and it seems that he was aware of those. When he graduated school, he became a notary. He wasn't old enough to become a priest. Remember, you have to be 25. So he became a notary, and he tutored the children of Scottish noblemen until he becomes a Protestant. He finally accepts the Protestant faith probably in 1543, and his first mission is to wield the sword to defend George Wishart. So that's probably enough of the introduction. I can't get into any more about where he's at. We'll stop right here with his conversion. And by the way, Knox gives us no information about his conversion. He's kind of like Calvin in that respect, is he doesn't talk about his conversion or what he believed before he became Protestant, really. We know he was Roman Catholic. We know he was at least in the process of taking orders. He was trained as a priest. It's possible he was ordained. There's some lack of clarity there, but he doesn't like to talk about it. And then I'll leave you there, and I'll come back, and I'll pick up where he's at in St. Andrews and what happens to him after that. So I'll conclude with our exposition right there.